This episode is dedicated to Adam and Nathan. Thank you. All right, welcome back to Sci-Fi and Fantasy Read Along. I am ATN.
I am Yule.
And I'm Phil.
You dropped the DM, huh?
Yule kind of abbreviated it, so I was like, I kind of shortened it a little bit to make it to conform, because I'm a conformist.
Wait. I can't shorten my name any more than Yule. I don't know what you're talking about.
It's three letters. I mean, come on.
All right, fine. I'm DM Phil.
You know what? I'm going to call you GM Phil for.
Oh, yeah.
Grandmaster. Because I want to play a little game in a little while, and I'll tell you about it when we get there.
All right.
So in our last episode, Salvor Hardin outmaneuvered his political rivals and the regent of Anacreon to overcome the Foundation's second crisis, possibly its third. I would argue it's the third and that Harry Seldon overcame the first one, but whatever. A crisis. How you guys doing?
Pretty good, man. Pretty good.
Yeah, man. Fantastic.
I saw Yule going for the thumbs up, and I'm like, nobody can hear that. Dude.
Nobody can hear that thumb up you're going to do there.
Do it harder.
But if you are on YouTube and you're watching this video that is nothing but us talking and you can't see it, give us a thumbs up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
And make
if you like what we're
down
doing,
below. It helps the algorithm.
So, fellas, you guys are both doing pretty good. Did you have a good read?
I did. I had a good nap, too. I feel like $1,000,000.
Good. Glad to hear it.
This was a nice abbreviated chapter as far
it's
as
it's a pretty
length.
Short chapter, but I have a feeling it's going to take a little while because it was pretty packed with information, even though it was short.
Yeah,
that is true. Yeah. That is true. But yeah, I like this chapter. I liked it. I think last one was certainly my favorite, but I liked this one. It was good.
Yeah, you were gushy last time.
Was I?
Oh, yeah, you were gushy.
Was it him?
No, it was we've done three now. Yeah, it was the third one. So like, yes, when he outsmarted everybody on every planet, it was just so good.
What did I tell you, Yule?
That's the
what
thing
did
he likes.
This is what
DM Phil is going to be known for. He's going to be known for, well, if someone outsmarts a dunderhead, he loves it.
Yes, it's exactly what happened.
Maybe it's because I wish I could be that guy that just outsmarts these guys all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like the term dunderhead.
I had a teacher when I was a kid that if you screwed up royally in class or disturbed stuff, he would make you put a garbage can on your head, walk around the classroom, and say, I am a dunderhead.
Wow, did it work?
I don't think I really straightened up now.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds to me like clown training, not deterrence.
Yeah, right. But it's, you know, it's funny. It's probably illegal now.
Oh, it was a private school.
He might still get sued by a parent.
I know my father was not happy with that. This will make a great clip and not part of the show.
Well, I prefer to call them ding-dongs, and they do seem to be everywhere in Isaac Asimov's world, his galaxy, his universe. Like, everybody's a ding-dong, as far as I can tell, except for very few select people.
Well, I think is Asimov like me, where he just wants to be smarter than everybody else and prove it? And this is,
I don't know.
This is him coming out in his characters?
It seems a little bit like there's some revenge. Like, he might have been mistreated by some people who were jock types, and now he's having his revenge by making fun of, you know, people who can only focus on athletics and war and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
All of his characters, his main characters, are super, super intelligent, very well educated, and they just make fools of the people around them.
Every single main character to date has had that persona of outthinking somebody else.
Yes. And I have a big complaint with this one in this chapter. Like,
I don't. I liked it. It was
magnificent. I predicted that you would like it. And I also predicted that I wouldn't.
Well,
and I was correct.
You predicted it after you read it? You predicted that you didn't think you'd like it?
Yes, exactly.
Well, that's hilarious.
I run a constant model as I'm reading, right? And I'm like, huh, this is going down a path I don't like. Huh, this is going down a path I don't like. And then I'm like, yep, it got to that place. And I'm like, I don't like this place.
Well, it's funny. You have to read four sections, though, to figure out that pattern that's just been consistent in every one.
Yes. It becomes apparent. And at this point, I would say it's pretty apparent that this is Asimov, at least at this stage of his career, that is the way that he was writing his character
well,
or whatnot.
If he is trying to just like one up somebody or some jock that mistreated him in the past, this is a flaming example of the pen is mightier than the sword.
Exactly. All right, so we've caught up, I do believe. Are you guys ready to begin? Let me turn this light on.
Affirmative.
So we begin with an excerpt from the Encyclopedia Galactica. The subject is traders, as in people who trade goods. They are the advanced and commerce arm of the Foundation, making contact throughout the periphery, thus extending their grasp ever further. And their ethics might not be the highest.
It says in the Encyclopedia Galactica, when it's talking about the traitors, that a lot of them have adopted some of Salvor Hardin's epigrams. And one of his favorites was, never let your sense of morals prevent you from doing what is right. I don't know. I love that. Well, you know, there's process-oriented people and there's goal-oriented people. And to me, the ends justify the means almost every time. So that's a perfect example of it.
Well, I think we should examine this probably in a little bit closer, what that means. It's going to come up later on in this chapter.
Yes, it absolutely is.
And I think this might, I don't know, maybe we might have a longer conversation about it than you think.
I wouldn't be surprised, actually, because it definitely comes up. I saw it happen.
Fine, let's go deep into that.
So chapter one, I can't read my own writing. This is amazing. Why do I do this to myself?
Lim.
All right. Nope.
Lamar Ponyets.
Yes, his name, Lamar Ponyets.
Yeah, I thought it was Lamar.
Oh, I like that.
Why not? Lamar. It's familiar for people from Texas. So chapter one, in which we meet one such trader who is neatly ensnared in a rescue mission. His name is Lamar Ponyets. He's taking a space shower wherein his spaceship space phone rings.
It does. And on the other end is this dude named Les Gorm.
He gets the phone call, and then 3 hours later, there's another ship pulled up right alongside of him, right? And it's Gorm's ship, and Gorm's comes over, and he sits down. He's like, hey, got this personal capsule for you.
Yeah, he's smoking a cigarette.
Like, seriously.
That would have been pervasive in that time.
Well, like, they're smoking cigars already, so, yeah.
Yes. It was pervasive through the 80s.
I think it's funny that, yeah, smoking is ubiquitous in this book, but drinking is rare.
I mean, it's common enough that it's happened two or three times. You know, like, how much drinking do you need in a book to enjoy it?
How much smoking do you need in a book to enjoy it?
None.
Not anymore.
I don't need any snus. I don't need any snuff. I don't need tobacco. I don't need any of it. I smoked plenty long. I'm glad I quit. Couldn't be happier.
Yeah, but even still, tobacco for a long time has been a very American thing. You know, it was the crop, right?
Come on, James Dean, the Marlboro Man. I mean, the imagery.
Well, what I'm saying is it's really hard to... It's one thing to, like, imagine what's going to happen in the future. But social trends and, you know, those are even harder, I think. You know, you don't know if the hoop skirt's going to go out of fashion.
What do you mean nobody smokes? That's what? When did they quit? Why? How did they quit?
Well, because they started taxing the hell out of them.
I went to Chicago when I was, I don't know, a while back. And I remember cigarettes were like $14 a pack. And I was like, what the hell? How does anybody afford this? Like, I mean, that's a luxury tax, right?
It sure is.
They go to Indiana. That's the answer. They drive around to the other state and they buy their cigarettes and they come back.
So they smoke.
There's these two fellows. That ding dong is smoking cigarettes on this other dude's ship. He didn't even ask. He just lights up.
Yeah, he did.
But he hand delivers this personal capsule, which is this tiny silver little sphere, and it's like locked to his DNA or something.
Only he can open it, right?
Yeah. So it opens in his hand and this like metallic film unrolls and he reads the message on there that's, you know, for his eyes only, essentially.
Yeah, and as he's reading it, the message is like disintegrating behind his like reading it.
Which was amazing.
I think that was really cool. That was very well done. And I tried to look for examples where it did, like there's real world examples of paper turning black and corroding?
I've seen it. I think it was magnesium. I couldn't find the video. I don't remember if it was the Periodic Kingdoms video people that did it. There's a Nottingham University that has periodic videos. And I think it was magnesium foil. And it just decays, turns black, and like disintegrates.
Well, this was not metallic. It was thin, transparent tape.
Which could have magnesium in it. I mean, who knows,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Either way, I thought it was a very interesting...
It was a very sci-fi thing to happen.
Yes,
right?
Very cool.
For your eyes only, message, like, disintegrates as he's reading it. It was really, really cool. But it got me to thinking, like, is this kind of like Telegraph to Pony Express level communication? Like, how would you get mail if it wasn't a digital thing? You know, it's like it's got like it has to be either 3D printed on your ship or somebody has to deliver it to you or send it ahead of you so you can go and pick it up when you arrive at your location.
Well, they
which seems unlikely in the periphery, right?
Well, certainly they ship parcels, but and they do have like interstellar communicators or whatever. But they said this was too important to risk getting captured by someone. Intercepted.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So it was a hand-delivered message. That's why they did that.
Super secret. All right. So he's not allowed to explain this to the gentleman that delivered it to him. Gorm doesn't get in on the information, at least not all of it, because it is so secret. But basically a traitor, one of their kind, has been imprisoned on the planet of Azkon. Azkon. How do you guys want to pronounce this word? Because to me, it's Azkon.
I think it's Azkon. Azkon.
I'd say Azkon.
Or Azkon, Azkon.
Or Azkone, I don't know.
When I think Azkon, I think of like...
I'm not saying Azkon. That's
never.
Two S's, dude. It's Azkon. That's what it was. It's Azkone.
I think it's Azkon.
Azkone.
Azkon.
Azkon. Azkon.
Azkon.
Azkon.
Azkon.
Azkon.
Azkon.
Okay. So a traitor, one of their kin, people, type, peers, whatever, has been imprisoned on the planet of Azkon, and it's because he was interfering with politics. And that's all that this Les Gorm fella gets to find out. So, you know, he's done his job, he's delivered his message. He and Poignance talk a little bit. We find out that Poignance is really far behind quota and that this is really going to set him back.
That's a big deal, it seems. I mean, obviously.
Well, these two guys are part of a traitor's guild. And with that affiliation comes a certain amount of liberty and freedom and ability to pass without being harassed.
It seems like his papers are worth something as far as that goes, but it also seems like he's basically a traveling salesman.
Well, he is a traveling salesman, but there's also this interstellar agreement whereby they are not harassed. It's called like a charter or something like that. And in return, they have agreed not to interfere with anybody's politics or to go where they're
not
wanted.
Which is, that's the prime directive. Bam.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think about that. Good job. Good catch.
Yeah. Yeah, I watch plenty of Star Trek, man.
Except for the fact that this dude is not really just a traitor.
Hold on to that thought, because he did go to prison for interfering with their politics, and that's when Gorm leaves.
And the thing, the fact of the matter is, this guy, Gorov, is not a traitor, really. What he is...
He's called Master Traitor Eskil Gorov.
Yeah, exactly. And he's an agent, or maybe even a spy for the Foundation.
Hands, that dude's a spy.
Now, when we get into the nitty-gritty of what is going on, it doesn't really feel as... I mean... It is pretty subversive, actually. And even though these people are ding-dongs on this planet, they're shrewd also. I mean, they're shrewd to be wary of what's being offered them.
You're referring to the ding-dongs on the planet Azkon?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
But we're getting into that next chapter.
All right, so we learned a couple of things from this chapter, one of which was that... Poignance is also trained in the priesthood. He was trained, and then he was kicked out of the priesthood because his ethics weren't really all that good, is what it seems like. That he was too concerned with making money, I believe is what it was. But he's got the training, and I kind of want to put that bug in your ear right now. because it's not something that I saw right away. It took me a little while to figure it out. But
well, I think he was just, he didn't fully drink the punch. But either way, he was trained by the Foundation, but he quit and became a traitor.
He was in the priesthood, and when they kicked him out, they just sent him into a different school in the Foundation. Because he's a smart guy. He's a really smart guy. So I got this notion, but it wasn't the first time. Like, I read this all the way through, and then some point in time, I was just wandering around, and the thought hit me that his training in religion is kind of important. And I'm gonna bring it up every time it comes up, but it comes up in pretty much every chapter, as far as I can tell. All right, chapter 2. After a week of travel time, and then a week of greasing bureaucratic wheels on Azkan, Poignets now stands before the Grand Master and his retinue. What follows is a reenactment of actual events that took place in super deep space a long time ago.
All right, so...
Don't speak!
Yeah,
that's right! I can't endure useless chatter. You cannot threaten me. I won't abide flattery, nor is there room for injured complaints. You have been warned. We don't want your devil's machines. Why are you here?
Look, accidents happen. My guy got here, and this isn't really, you know, the way it seems.
That's ridiculous. This was clearly a setup, because I was already getting negotiations 2 hours after this guy was arrested. So something is going on here.
Gorov is sitting in prison. There must be something we can do to get this guy out.
Your goods are wicked and accursed.
Well, there has to be something you want, then.
Well, we've heard the Foundation is rich.
Well, yeah, but we're only rich technologically.
He's going to get death by gas, which everybody gets that here. No matter how rich or how poor or how wealthy or smart or dumb, everybody gets death by gas who is essentially an unredeemer.
Irredeemable. Even you.
That's right. Even me would get no less.
Well, if Gorov is destined to die by gas, there must be... How about I can maybe go and have a conversation with him?
Asconian law allows no communication with a condemned man.
Well, what about a spiritual counselor?
Whoa, you are a tender of the soul?
Sure, I've dabbled in it.
All right, thank you. Thank you for humoring me. Let's discuss the important ideas that were revealed in here, though, okay?
Yeah.
What are they? Do you guys have any notions of, like, what's, like, really, really important to you?
To me?
Yeah.
Yeah. The concept is that it's a Gorov. It's what Gorov is.
Gorov is in prison.
He's in prison for trying to advance the Foundation's interests, and he does that through religious and technological ways.
It's like he's trying to sell booze, Bibles, and bacon in the Middle East.
Exactly. He is a missionary. And yeah. It's like, hey, guess what? I got a flashlight. You're going to go to these people, and isn't this great?
A penknife, a razor.
A penknife. If you get caught with a penknife, you are in a lot of trouble.
Junk.
You know, eventually that penknife or that flashlight or whatever it is going to have a battery that needs to be replaced. And that's where the insidiousness of missionaries are. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like, if we're dealing with nuclear-powered flashlights, like, it'll probably never need batteries, man.
Things need to be fixed, is what I'm saying.
Planned obsolescence hadn't been invented yet.
Well, I guess what they were thinking of is that, you know, if you see your neighbor with an electric razor that never gets dull, you're like, I want one.
And he's always got the perfect shave.
Yeah.
Well, and I think I said last time that it's like going to a soup kitchen that's involved with a church. You know, you have to kind of sit and maybe, you know, hang out for the prayer before you get that soup.
Sit through it, you mean?
Sit through it, yeah. That's what I mean.
That's the cost.
It's the cost for getting that. And the cost for getting these goods is, you know, buy into our Foundation.
Yeah, our belief structure, belief system. Right. Being under their thumb. That's the idea.
To my understanding, Gorov was supposed to be here under an assumed guise of being a traitor, not as a representative of the Foundation.
Hold on. We know he's a spy.
We know.
Essentially.
We know.
Because of, yeah. But there's like, we're right on the edge of going into the next chapter.
Well, I know, but that, I guess my understanding here is I thought it was clear that he was an operative of the Foundation, but not under the guise, he was acting under the guise of a traitor when he got here because of cell nucleics. He was not here to proselytize the Foundation or to...
I think it's one and the same thing, essentially. They assume that one will follow the other, but I believe it's explained in the next chapter.
Yeah, that's fine. But my point is, right here, I guess it was on page 149, the Grandmaster says the Foundation is rich. I'm like, hey, how do they know Gurov was from the Foundation?
Well, the Foundation is contacting them so that he can be released, I think.
It's revealed later on also that like they're that's been a constant headache. Like the Foundation has always been like, "Hey, can we get when can we come over?" And he doesn't, he's like, "Get out of here. Stay away from us." Keep having to remind you.
It's like that evangelist kid who went to that island in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah, and got eaten.
Well, we don't know if he got eaten. He definitely got killed.
He shouldn't have gone back.
Yeah.
You know what we're talking about, Yul?
I think I do, yeah.
He was trying to proselytize to a group of headhunters.
Oh, yeah, well, that's what happens.
And they shot him full of arrows, and he escaped to a boat, and then he went back.
He went back,
after he'd
yeah.
healed up a little bit, and they killed him. Or at least nobody's seen him since.
Wow. That's some crazy belief, man.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I don't think that's what we're dealing with in this case. I think that this is a guy who completely and utterly ignored the borders, set his ship down, and tried to make a strategic sail and got caught. I don't know how clever he thought he was being, but obviously when Poignets showed up, like they had spotted him 2 parsecs out because they still have those little ships that are left over from the Galactic Empire.
Not warships. They're like corvettes, they said, or something like that. Luxury ships.
Well, that's fine, but they're able to detect him. So they were probably able to detect Gurov right away as well.
Certainly.
So they just followed him or observed him. And then they're like, what is this guy doing? And he had straight to the middle of their system.
Let's just say deception and subtlety are not his strong points.
This guy is a ding dong.
He obviously slept through the prep for this mission.
Did he do it to get caught?
I don't know if he did it to get caught or not. He certainly crossed into their system. Like it's not a mistake.
And if Gurov is such a great spy.
I don't think he's a great spy. I think he's in AT&T.
He's just a master trader.
He's a master ding dong.
Yeah, something like that.
I thought it was interesting. It's in this section at the very end when you see Poignets is a very skillful, he's very
negotiator,
shrewd businessman. He knows how to read people. He knows how to discern what is important to them and find a way to give it to them.
And yet he couldn't figure out an alternate method of payment for this guy.
Well, that's because that's true, but he's still working on it. But he didn't even recognize what is valuable, but he knows religion is valuable, and he used that to get what he wanted.
Yes, he did, and that becomes exceptionally clear in the next chapter. Chapter 3, in which Poignets and the prisoner Gurov discuss best strategies. So I just want to throw out there that he's wearing a bracelet. It's a special bracelet. It prevents the Asconians from spying on them. And also what Philip just said is revealed in their earliest conversation, that Poignets used religion. He saw it as an opportunity. Maybe this will work since nothing else is working. He's plying religion on a religious people, and it did work to get him an audience with Gurov. Right?
I think that's a pretty shrewd move.
I do too. I think it's real smart.
I mean, that's the first thing religion. I think, you know. These people are religious. They're going to be easy to be duped.
May I tend to his soul, sir?
I'm going to start speaking in tongues, you know?
All right, so Poignets' confusion in the last chapter, not being able to figure out what the Grand Master actually wanted, well, it's revealed by Gurov that he just wants gold.
He just wants gold.
Gold? What does he want with the metal?
Yeah, he's like, why? It has no practical value.
Well, it's their currency, it turns out. And as long as the Grand Master is promised gold and lots of it, Gurov is not actually in any real danger, right?
Well, yeah, but the Foundation doesn't have any gold.
The Foundation can get gold, though. They are wealthy. They can just trade nucleics for gold somewhere, and that's what he suggests. He's like, yeah, go back if you have to. Just get a bunch of gold and give it to him. We'll fly away from this place, and then Poignets is like, and then you're just going to turn right around and come back and do it again. He's like, yeah, that's my job.
That's my mission.
Now, this is like your guy with the arrows in his back.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. He's like, they're going to kill you. I'm like, well, that's my mission. And they'll do it again until he dies.
He doesn't seem real bright, this Gorov fella. You know, like, he went about it in a real obvious way. Like, it was obvious to everybody. Like, is it supposed to be obvious so that he'd get caught so they could sucker Ponyets into coming out here because he's actually the guy they want to be doing this job?
Well, that's what he That's what I was thinking, because he takes it.
Well, no, Ponyets has the religious background and the actually like negotiating skill sets of a traitor to be able to succeed. Whereas Gorov, who he knew, they were friends or at least associates at one time, is kind of a ding dong. You're right, man. This Gorov, it was way too simple of a screw up. And
it was a blatant screw up, right?
Yes, it was the justification was so flimsy it has to be a setup for Ponyets.
And Ponyets thought about this, I think, in Chapter 1. He was like, it's awfully convenient that I'm in the neighborhood when this guy goes and gets caught. And it's looking a little bit like having that religious background. That's the thing. Like, somebody knew that that was going to be valuable in this situation, and that's what it was going to take. And so they're, like, kind of calling a spy in who's been on the bench. You're like, look, you, born identity, it's your turn. Get in there, man. Okay, so what is Gorov's actual mission? What's the purpose behind Gorov's mission?
All right, so the deal is they introduce into Azkone society what the nucleics and all the technological advancements.
The atomic razor blades and the never-ending flashlights and exactly. All the other garbage that they sell these people.
And all you have to do is adopt our beliefs in the Foundation. Which is, you know, more and more feeling like a religion.
Yeah, but they have a really pragmatic goal. Their goal is for the security of the Foundation. Yes. They're
and
like,
of course,
these people
that's
are
the traitor's philosophy, ATN. Don't let morals get in the way of, you know, doing what's right.
And the Foundation is the same thing.
If I don't want to adopt what you have, am I really, you know, if I have to eschew all these things that you're giving me? And I'm speaking for, you know, the Grand Master here.
The nucleics?
Yeah, the nucleics and everything. That's my sense of morality and doing what's right also, you know. Can you really do the right thing and ignore your morals? I guess this is really what I want to ask.
But I don't know, man.
I mean, they're your morals and you can go against them to do the right thing.
Okay, so let's set up the Azkonian rules, essentially. They are a group that has ancestor worship, which I think is something similar to what the Japanese have, right? They have this sort of ancestor worship, and their ancestors have forbidden the technology, the high science, and the futuristic technology that we would think of that was associated with the Galactic Empire. When the Empire collapsed, the Azkonians kicked the Galactic Empire, whoever they were, they kicked them off the planet and take your technology with you. Right? That
sure.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so now it's forbidden. That technology's forbidden. They still use the old ships and they haven't thrown any of that stuff away because it's very useful to them.
They got grandfathered in, I guess.
Yeah, essentially. So the idea is that if somebody from the Foundation can come in there and strategically sell nucleics to somebody in the court, they will have a self-interest in their motivation for making it legal for them to use the technology
sure.
that they have
well,
become enamored with.
To put it in a different way, they're trying to seduce the powerful people of this planet to get addicted or to get enthralled with these... Oh, addicted is a good one. To get enthralled with these devices so that then they'll...
Strung out. Let's continue the metaphor. They're trying to string them out on the junk.
Oh, you mean tobacco?
Oh,
well. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
Once they realize how awesome these devices are, they'll start changing the rules to adopt them. It's like, oh, you'll sacrifice your principles when it's too convenient to, when the benefit is so great, I mean, your principles disappear. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Self-interest still rules the day.
Yes.
Right?
Well, the point is the Foundation can't control a planet that refuses to have give them audience or doesn't.
Do you remember the fable from last chapter about the horse
yes,
and the man
yes.
and the this is a horse that won't let the man ride.
Right.
Mm,
they're like no, we've got this. We can handle the wolves ourselves. Thank you. And the Foundation will not rest until they have everybody under their thumb, because after all, they are carving out a new Foundation. They're carving out a new empire out here in the periphery. All right, so this is Gorov and Punyets still in the cell, still having their little discussion, and Punyets is like, wait, your plan is ridiculous, and you're not a salesman, which is patently obvious at this point, so why did they send you, Ding Dong? Because, I mean, I think he's correct in assessing this man as, like, not the right guy for the job. So he tells him to step aside, that he's not doing it for the Foundation, but if you want something sold, get a traveling space salesman to do it.
It reminds me of my father when he would have me mow the lawn. And if he came out and didn't like what I was doing, he'd finish it up so it was done right.
Ooh, so you never did it right the first time, did you?
He screwed that one up. No, I did fine afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It seemed like, you know, this guy's like, this incompetence, I'm going to take care of it.
Do you remember the show Community, Yule?
I know of it.
Did you ever watch anything from the last season?
Oh, no, I did not.
There's an episode called Grifting 101. And, like, when I got to this chapter, at the end of this chapter, I was like, oh, I sense a grift. I sense a grift coming. That's how I ended this chapter.
So I guess to sum it up the way I understand it is Punyets realizes that Grov, there's no way he's going to succeed at this mission until he's going to die before he succeeds.
Well, he's exactly. One, he's in prison, and two, he's just going to, like, go and bang his head against the wall as soon as he gets out of here and get imprisoned and killed again.
But he's also, Punyets is also an opportunist, so he's like, I'm going to finish your mission for you, and I'm going to get rich doing it. That's what he said.
Chapter 4, in which a traitor pitches a hard sell to the Grand Master of Azkun and his many men. So Punyets is setting up a device in front of all of these men, these wizened, bearded, old curmudgeons. And it's like kind of janky because he built it himself. And he's real careful because he wants to make sure it works properly when he demonstrates his thing. And the old Grandmaster, he recognizes it for what it is.
He does?
Yeah, he's like, transmutation. Ah, yes. Many have tried.
Lead into gold, right?
Iron
into gold.
Into gold.
Yes.
And, okay, so interesting note, at least to me, it was interesting. Like, I was like, can you do this? Can you take a particle collider and can you smash iodine because it's got the atomic weight necessary to add to the iron to get to gold? Like, gold is atomic weight 79, you know, iron is 26, you need a 53. You have to add 53. I don't know if it's actually possible. But something that I heard is that CERN, they had noticed there was a buildup in their device. Like some metal was building up on the inner walls. And they tested it, and it turns out that it was like 90% gold.
What?
It's like building up gold on the ends. It's only 4 microns thick. It's extremely thin. It's a side product of them smashing atoms together. So, like, you can probably make gold with an atom smasher.
Well, it sounds like you can.
It does sound like you can.
And it's my understanding is that within stellar evolution, I'm going on my nerd rant here. So, in stellar evolution, the heaviest element you can naturally make within the core of a star is iron. All heavier elements are created during the Big Bang.
Higher energy events.
Yes, higher energy events. Thank you very much. Are capable.
Supernovas, yes. Collisions of black holes.
So within a core of a star going supernova, you can create heavier elements like uranium and gold and all this other stuff.
Well, what he has created, what he's constructed, and what he's choosing to demonstrate has an anode. It's not a super collider. I thought he was going to scam them with a simple plating technique, right? But no, he's so confident that the buckles that he's put in there that were iron are now gold that he's like, go ahead, test it. Test it in any way you can.
Yeah, doesn't he like offer himself up for like, you know, quarantine for like 30 days or something like that?
Yeah, it's the last thing that he does in the chapter. Once he has convinced the Grand Master that your ancestors would not disapprove of the gold. They might disapprove of the machine, but they won't disapprove of the gold because you're just going to honor them with.
Yeah,
the,
you're going to make like gilded archways and stuff like
that
for them.
Yeah, he's like, plate your temples with it. And then like, ooh.
He convinces the Grandmaster with this kind of reasoning. So the Grandmaster wanted to be convinced. We already know he wanted the gold. He just doesn't want the machine. He considers the machine to be, you know, vile.
Right, well, Ponyets points out, like, because they get trade from all of several other systems, but they never ask where that trade comes from or how it's produced. They're just willing to accept it. It's and right. that's his reasoning is just like, okay, well, if you accept stuff regardless of its source and how it's made, you can do the same thing with the gold. And they're like, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Right. So the Grandmaster is convinced. His favorite, this gentleman, young guy, skinny, named Furl, he is very vociferously opposed to this whole thing. Bad idea, terrible. Our ancestors would not approve. But the Grandmaster just kind of shushes him. And old Ponyets, then he's like, on top of that, I'm going to sit in a prison cell for 30 days while you put this gold in your ancestors' altars. And if there's a disaster anywhere on your system, it was because of the gold. It's still dirty.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it was horrible. I'm like, why did you say 30 days? Because if there was going to be like divine retribution, it would happen soon. But if 30 days, you leave yourself open to anything happening. There's not a single point on our planet where something bad doesn't happen. And you can blame who knows what on it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the opportunity to even have somebody set him up.
Dude, I would say 7 days.
I don't even know if you... I mean, he volunteered it after the fact. After the Grandmaster had been convinced. He didn't need to give it even a day. He didn't need to. He had a goal in mind, though, because he had identified old Furl as a sucker. He's like, this guy, he's my victim. He's the one. I'm gonna grift this sucker.
Well, there is that, but I mean, he's also looking at, you know, farther in the future with who he's really communicating with also.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that goes hand in hand with he's found his man, essentially, right? All right, so Furl, we get a pretty good idea of what Furl is like in the next chapter. Are you guys ready to move on?
Mm-hmm. I am.
Did we skip anything in there? Chapter 5, in which Ponyets baits his hook. So a week has passed, and Ponyets is still a prisoner, but he's now being held at Furl's personal estate. You remember just a minute ago, Yule, said that Furl's the kind of guy that thinks he can go toe-to-toe with smart people.
Right. When talking with Ponyet, Furl thinks that he would... thinks out loud with him that he would have done things a little bit different. That he
yeah, he said he was sloppy.
Yeah, but in what way?
Well, he said that it irked them. Like, he pissed off the Grandmaster. And, like, if he'd have just done it on his ship, nobody would have been mad. He could have just brought the gold and bought the guy.
Yeah, but the thing of the matter is and I do believe Ponyets totally says this, is that he wanted to get Furl's attention. He didn't really give two about what the Grandmaster thought.
That is true. He was actually aiming for an end,
but this is what he really wants to be with. And I assume that's why he said in the last chapter, that's why he wanted to be like 30 days imprisoned.
I assume that's correct. Yeah, he needed time.
I guess he knew he would be going over to Furl's place eventually.
He had to give Furl the opportunity to act, right? You can't do it immediately or he would show his hand, right? He had to let him be smart about it. He had to let him not do what Regent Weenus had done and just go directly for his goal. He has to go a little bit around because he has to play within the rules of his society. He has to pretend that he also opposes these Nucleics. And remember, he was the most loudly opposed in the meeting in the previous chapter. He was like, no, this is evil.
Well, this is really fascinating because, one, maybe he's a little young and idealistic in his own. And when I say him, I'm talking about Furl. But it took me a couple of reads to figure out why he went for Furl. It's because the Grandmaster is old. His time is limited, right? And so he's
very old. He says he's ancient, I think.
It was easy to manipulate him to get the release of Gorov, but to accomplish the actual mission of the Foundation, he has to take it one level higher and corrupt Furl because he anticipates Furl will be the next Grandmaster, and he's young, which means if you can corrupt Furl, you're going to have a very long history of time where you have somebody in office receptive to the Foundation.
And as a result, he's going to get paid off.
Hella paid.
Because he ain't meeting it right now.
Hella paid. Yeah.
Do you think that Poignets, when he was putting his contraption together to make gold,
which he was doing clumsily,
was
and carefully,
was it a show? Was it an act? So that he could like maybe place himself at least.
I think that was him baiting the hook.
Yeah,
that's all that was. Okay, cool.
So no, he was very meticulous and careful in operating the machine.
He said he had to get it right. It had to go 100% correctly the first time when he demonstrated it.
I think what Furl mentioned was his plan, which was to bring the machine to them and make it gold for them instead of doing it in our home. That was clumsy. That was amateurish.
I see.
That's
okay.
What Furl thinks, yes.
Okay, I see.
And that he's a smart man. He would have done it. This is how he would have done it.
Well, see, now that's what because like in the courtroom when he's put, or whatever room, it seemed like that he was, since he was taking his time, maybe there was a little bit of a show is all.
He might be playing dumb.
That's what I really was trying to get at. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he might have been playing dumb, baiting the hook essentially, trying to get this guy, because he's identified this guy as young and brash and probably kind of bright, right? At least Furl thinks he's bright. He thinks he can go toe-to-toe with Poignets.
Well, he is bright. I mean, to be able to be so young on the council, he is bright and capable and shrewd.
Yes, and he's maneuvered himself into a position where he can be the next Grand Master. But as Poignets points out, he's young, he's from a young family, and he's not from the Five Tribes, so he's going to need a lot of funding to ensure that he's the next Grand Master.
Yes, he appeals to his sense of inadequacy. Which is...
And greed and family pride. Yes, a lot of things.
So get this guy on board with the Nucleics, and he will be forever voting in favor of...
For a long, long time.
And that's
time.
What he said, is like, everybody else on the council is a member of the Five Tribes. Do you think they're going to allow you, who's not a member, be part of that? No. But you can do it. You can buy your way in.
Right. So he suggests that... Furl buy this machine from him. That way he can print his own money and he can guarantee himself that next position as Grand Master, right? And Furl's like, well, I can't use these machines because they'll kill me if they catch me using this machine. And he's like, oh, well, you know, you just hide it in a dungeon somewhere and print money. And his price for selling him the transmuter is, what did he say? He said it was 1 cubic foot of gold's worth of wrought iron.
I don't know what the conversion rate is, but...
I do.
All right, great. Let's tell us, what is the current conversion rate between gold?
Do you want the current value, or do you want the inflated value?
Well, gold is what, 1850 right now?
Let me explain what I did, and then we can talk about the actual figures, okay? A cubic foot of gold... is 1,206 pounds, or 17,587.5 troy ounces. Gold in 1943 to 1944 was approximately $36 an ounce, so that amounts to $633,150 worth of gold in that time, which translates from inflation to $9.5 million today. And he wants that much money's worth of wrought iron.
Oh my gosh, how much iron is that in today's dollars? In today.
Well, wrought iron sells from between $1 to $3 a pound.
Pound?
Oh, okay. Yes, if you buy it. So it's a massive, massive amount of money.
Well, either way, it is more than a ton of iron. How many tons of iron is that?
It's many. It's 9.5 million pounds of iron, wrought iron.
Do you want me to do the math?
It's 630. Let's just call it 633,150 pounds.
How much?
But I mean, how much was iron then? That's why I'm doing it that way, right? That's why it's 9.5 million pounds, because iron, whatever it cost back, I can't figure out what iron cost then. And it's not iron; it's wrought iron. There's a difference. So if you knew how much wrought iron was then, you could figure it out. But assume it's up to 10 cents or something, right? It's going to be a very small amount. So it's a lot. It's a lot of metal. Probably enough to fill his ship. So the guy is like, Ferrell is like, that is ridiculous. I'm not going to pay you that right now. I need at least a week to run this machine to make sure it works. Because what if it breaks the minute I pay you and you leave? So no, you're going to be my prisoner. If you raise a stink, I'm going to have you executed for trying to bribe me. And we see there's a twinkle in Whiskey Jack's eye. So that's a callback to the previous book that we did, Gardens of the Moon. But there's a twinkle in old Ponyett's eye. He's getting what he wants in this moment, even though the kid thought he could go toe-to-toe with this guy and outmaneuver him. Apparently he's wrong.
Wait, there was the very last thing on Chapter 5.
What was
where
it?
Where Ferrell says, "No, sir, only one of us is a fool." And Cho said, "It is agreed then."
So Chapter 6, in which our heroes chuckle at the Azkon dupes. So Goroff is released some days later. He was exchanged for 500 pounds of gold. And he and Poignets are being escorted from the system separately in their separate ships, but they're talking over the relay, the hyper relay, hyperwave, whatever they call it, the ether, essentially.
They're making their getaway.
Well, they're not actually making their getaway. They're on their way somewhere.
Yeah, where are they going?
Yeah, where are they going?
I don't remember.
They're going to Ferrell's mining colonies.
Wait. His mining colonies? What for?
To pick up all the tin that he shiced
for.
Oh,
that's right. And that's where we're finding out finally what the ultimate plan of Poignets
is. It's revealed just like a murder mystery.
Well, it is.
Right?
But Goroff is like, he's really upset and he's flipping out because he thinks that Poignets has completely botched the entire job.
Yeah, he did it wrong.
Oh, man, I had a theory that Goroff might not have been as dumb as we thought, but now I'm thinking he is again. Depending on who put these things in motions, they might be the mastermind of the whole thing anyway. Knowing right. that Goroff is going to be this way, you know, this guy is sitting out here and he's going to be relaying, you know. But unfortunately, at the end of this chapter, there's no Harry Seldon part, so I don't know who it was.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, this might be an unforeseen crisis. Not necessarily unforeseen, but like one that just goes under the radar. They don't realize that a crisis has been passed here.
Or averted, or maybe it's the beginning of one to happen.
Or maybe they did. Maybe they did know this was kind of critical. But we have no idea because we have no contact with the Foundation.
Right.
Or the inner thoughts of the Foundation.
It's very tenuous, our grip with them right now. But yes, the entire thing is explained. The grift actually was not really a grift. It was blackmail. Because this dumb kid, Ferrell, he'd never heard of a recording device. So he went and used this thing and was recorded using this thing, converting the iron to gold. And then, you know.
And then celebrating the fact that he has created gold.
Oh, it's amazing. He just became super, super rich, right? He just cemented himself as the next Grand Master. He's happy. He's proud. He thinks he's outsmarted this guy. And then he's confronted with a video, a 3D color video of him. And he's like, busted.
Well, that's the problem also when you're keeping all this technology away.
Forbidden. Yeah. So the same thing that was going to happen to Goroff. This kid's going to die. If it's revealed... The crowd, he says, is going to tear him apart.
Oh, but Poignets says he's going to project this in the square, basically in the central square.
Times Square.
Yeah.
Public shaming. So he's got this kid basically right where he wants him, you know, and so he fire sales all of his stuff for double the price that he normally would have sold it for. And in exchange, he's going to take all the tin that he and Goroff can fit in their ships as payment.
And,
because apparently tin is the stuff.
Well, tin is a lot more valuable than iron.
And that's what he wants, tin.
And Goroff is, not only was he questioning, the way he went about doing things poignant, but he also questions his morality.
Which is ironic, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the whole, what's the saying?
The traitor's saying was,
yeah. Brings
never
it all
let
in
a
big circle.
Sense of morals prevent you from doing what is right.
The long short of what Ponyuts did is he used his religious training like James Bond would. Like, it was training for him to do his job, right? He just used it to his advantage. He took advantage of religious people by having religious training. And he outsmarted them all and rubbed their noses in it a little bit. And now he's laughing as he flies away. I was a little disappointed, personally.
How so?
I wanted a grift. I wanted him to actually outsmart this kid. You know? Like, convince him to buy the stuff.
It's also about who's... excuse me. It's also about who's more technologically advanced than the other people.
Yes, exactly.
It's
which is
more than a grift when you like, yes, it was going to be a grift potentially, but I realized I didn't have to when I realized they didn't have electricity.
He did,
whatever.
He outsmarted this kid six ways from sideways.
Do you outsmart somebody when they have no knowledge of what you're doing?
No. No, it's like Clark Tech, you know, like we look at some technology and we're just like, it's magic, right? The kid has no idea. It's not, I mean, no, I completely. Well,
there
see your
is
point.
Another
I don't
think so. Person in our media, in our, you know, movie media that's out there that also reminded me of Ponyuts just a little bit. And Phil said it before we got on.
Yeah, but you do it. You go, Yul.
No. Since you said it and it backs me up, I like to hear you say it.
I swear.
What did you think? And we had no conversation about this, but the way Ponyuts was acting, and it's all about himself and getting that money. And you know what?
Well, and play.
Rebellion ain't that big a deal. Who do you think it was,
Phil? Oh, man. This was Han Solo all the way. Yeah. Ponyuts was Han Solo. He was like self serving. He was clever. He's ultimately going to betray somebody and get rich on it. I loved it, especially at the end when he said, "What are the odds?"
He was not doing it for the foundation. He was real clear about that.
Well, you know, you guys say he wasn't an outsmarter, but yeah, because he secured the release of Garov. He got them to buy into the Nucleics thing, and he earned double profit.
Yeah, no, he did a good job.
And he's
going to
meet his quota, right?
Yeah.
Yes, he's going to surpass his quota for sure. Yeah.
I mean, it was a win-win-win.
But
he didn't do it in a way
that, like, my expectation was the grift, and the grift is not blackmail, right? That's a crime. Blackmail is a crime. A grift is when you convince somebody to do something out of self-interest that turns out to be good for you and not for them, right?
Well, you have to be able to... you know, adjust on the fly sometimes. And again,
if you realize
that a dude doesn't know what's going on, you got to take advantage of it. And that's part of a grift also sometimes.
Well, he did take advantage. Yeah. Well, I keep running across this notion that like the people that our heroes are put into opposition with are ding-dongs. They're not.
Oh, and I thought you were going to say something about
religion. They're
just not on the same level. So it's just the dichotomy of characters. You have one guy who's knows everything and how to make sure everything happens the way it needs to happen, and then you have all these other rats that are running around, you know, doing things whether they know or not in service of that person. Mm. Is that what's going on that you don't like in this book?
Well, I don't really know. The stuff that I don't like is having like the expectation that he was going to outsmart this kid and the situation. Like, I just think that the situation wasn't really outsmarted. It was just blackmail.
I liked it.
Going back to Harrison Ford, do you remember when he had those guys
shot
with
first.
Swords against him?
That was Indiana
you
Jones.
Know, in Indiana Jones. And then he just pulls out his guns and shoots him instead. Everybody laughed in the theater. Thought it was the greatest thing ever.
It was.
Yeah. I feel like that's kind of what this is, you know? Maybe not. I mean, maybe it's just because I'm linking it to Han Solo and Harrison Ford. And, you know, this guy is a guy that...
I just feel like it's a mystery.
He's more...
Right?
Yeah, but when
it's
you're
a
only
mystery
into
reveal.
Your own self-interests, I don't think... I don't know. I don't know if you need to do that.
Asimov likes Agatha Christie, so I was kind of expecting something like that. you know, where Poirot figures it out and explains it to us. And he did. He explained it to us. But it wasn't him being smart. It was just him having an advantage and exploiting it.
Well, we got that last chapter, though.
I mean, I know.
This is a different character.
But it's the same thing.
When you're out on the fringes of the universe and you're trying to get this stuff in the back hauled, you know, within a few weeks to where it needs to go so you can meet your quota, you got to do anything and everything to get that done, ATN. Anything and everything.
When he said that his product was rotting in his cargo holds, I was like, what is he hauling? Strawberries? I was going to say meat or something like that.
Sloppy Joe's he had, and he had to sell that stuff.
Well, you know, what this actually made me think of is actually in Star Wars where, was it not The Last Jedi, it was the one with Rey where they found Rey, The Force Awakens, where...
Never heard of it.
Oh, yeah, you have. So when Han Solo was on that trader ship, that tug, whatever it was, transport ship, doesn't matter. So, and then, like, the Conja Club and Suavian Death Gang show up, and they're like... And then he talks his way out of it. And, you know, and then he's like, you do anything to get out? And he's like, I never made a deal with them, but obviously he did because he's this brilliant, you know, scoundrel in his own right. And when all things go south and the Rathars come out, he doesn't hesitate to throw that one right into the mouth of the Rathar. That's why this guy's Han Solo.
That one?
That one what?
He threw that one into the mouth of the Rathar?
Yeah.
That one what?
That one human.
What is this, in Solo?
I don't remember this, man. I don't remember. I'm sorry. That might be a really good story, but I need to see the movie again to follow you.
This wasn't Harrison Ford Han Solo, was it?
Yes, it was.
That was in Force Awakens? All that happened?
Yeah, when he was on...
God damn, that sounds like a good movie all of a sudden.
I don't remember that at all.
You guys got to watch it, because that was like a complete...
No, I don't. I seen it twice, and I can't remember that obvious. You know what I remember? When he got killed, and I laughed. I thought it was so funny.
Oh, I hate you, yo.
I was like, this guy... And it was right before he died. I'm like... Harrison Ford doesn't even want to be here. You can tell in this movie. And then he dies. I'm like, that was written in.
Yeah. He phoned that one in for sure.
Oh, man, that was like horrible. I mean, Han Solo was like a dad to it.
He's a dad to you.
He was my inspiration.
That man was like my father. Yeah, he was a scallywag. I don't know. That's fine. I don't know. You got anything else?
I'm good.
I just feel like this was the perfect guy for this situation. And like, he had the religious training. I think he was chosen for this mission, and they knew he would take it if put in the right situation. I just feel that way.
I could not agree more. I think this was a complete setup, and he's the one that got set up.
And everybody profited, and maybe back on Trantor, they're aware that one of the crises has just been overcome.
Trantor? Terminus.
So maybe back on Terminus, there's somebody aware that they've just overcome one of the crises sometime. Because like you said, it was pretty vague about the timing, the age and the year, you know, and all that nonsense.
Well, I think that's not unrealistic because Harry Seldon predicted all these things. And sometimes, you know, like right now, these people on Ascone or Ascon, whatever it is, they are not a threat right now. But if you pass up this opportunity right now before they become a problem, you might not be able to deal with it ever again. So this may be that time to like a stitch in time saves nine.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. So I mean, because it is one of the parts, I have to assume that this was a crisis, right? Because why would you show us the dull stuff, right? Why would you show us the boring stuff that doesn't matter?
It was probably a necessary brick that had to be set.
You know what would make me happy is bring all of this back in a future section, bring all of this back and then make me feel like I was wrong, right? My assumptions were wrong. Like it wasn't just black man. That would make me happy, but we'll see.
And what do you think of this novel that's obviously short stories that are continuing the advancement of this foundation?
Do you mean like, what do I feel about it right now?
Yeah,
based on everything
right
that
now?
We, yeah. I feel like it's kind of juvenile, that the villains are irrational in their motivations. and that the heroes are smarty pantses, and they're, I mean, that's kind of just how I feel. The characters are kind of a little too simple for me, and the challenges as they are 50-50 satisfying.
What about the scope of everything and how it's all working? You know, I guess world building.
I mean, I don't know yet. I think it's too early to judge. I feel okay about it because, like, the way that he's building the galaxy, it's kind of like he took us from the center of the heart of the galaxy and he sent us to the periphery, and then all immediately things start to disintegrate. But immediately we see the foundation is already, like, starting to develop. It was something that you said in episode 2 where you'd asked the question if the end ever really came. Like, if the end of the Galactic Empire actually ever happened, because the foundation is basically a direct continuation, right? So maybe there's an analog in history that I'm just not aware of. Is this Byzantium? Is this the Roman Empire after the Roman Empire fell?
I think it's a little different than that. This is essentially, if you think of Catholicism as an empire, that's what this is.
Yeah. Okay.
This is the fall of the Roman Empire. And
their technology is saving your soul?
You know, it's spun in a different way, but essentially the foundation has tendrils everywhere on the planet. Or, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, in the galaxy. Not everywhere, but they're spreading out in all directions.
In the periphery. Yeah, they're spreading in the periphery.
And they aren't a power in their own right, but they are obscenely influential. And so is the Catholic Church.
Okay. I'll go with that. I wondered about Azkun, and in the moment when I was reading it, if there was a historical analog to that confrontation where, you know, like somebody had come from the outside and tried to, like, you know, mingle, make contact, make some money, you know, and a society was like, nope, you're going to die.
Well, I think in the early days of the spread of Christianity, Catholicism, what have you, I'm going to use Catholicism as a specific one before Christianity splintered into so many different groups, but it was very common for missionaries to go convert people, and that was often a very dangerous thing.
Yeah, as it should be. Well, the question that was asked of me, Yule, like, turn it on yourself. Like, how do you feel about this book so far?
I think it's good, and the thing I find that I like the most is just how massive all of it is. And as a thing that's written in short stories and then built upon later on down the line, you know, that's kind of a neat thing.
Like a palimpsest. It's like a layer of paper with writing on it, and then more paper written over it, and then more paper written over it, building up a story.
Oh, I like that. I know.
That's the metaphor or whatever.
Or layers on your Photoshop.
Or it's canvas that you repeatedly paint over.
Sure thing. And that's how watercolors work, right? Or is that oils? I don't know.
Oils are built up over in layers. Yeah. Hundreds and hundreds of layers, yeah.
Amazing. So I'm kind of seeing this book like that, and some of the idiosyncrasies in the writing don't really affect me as much, and the fact that the characters aren't as fleshed out, I don't know if I would agree with you in that. Maybe they are kind of one-dimensional, and you're right, the good guys are really great. And the bad guys are very
poor. I think the good guys
are
less one-dimensional than the bad guys, but the bad guys are, like, self-destructively dumb.
I think in the form of a short story, it plays out a little differently. You know, if you're reading those pulp novels or magazines back in the day, you got to churn that stuff out, and it just works a whole lot differently. And you can't be so artistic and... It's not until, like, the lens of time changes that we look back on it and whether or not we're going to really, you know, put it in the stratosphere of great writing. But I like his ideas. Like, all science fiction is usually, it's heavy on ideas.
It is heavy on ideas. Do you think this book is overrated so far?
No.
No.
So, Philip, why don't you answer the same question?
I just did, but Yule, I'm sorry I interrupted, Yule. This is your...
No, it's okay. I agree with Phil. No, I don't. I mean, I'm looking at how it's, what's overrated?
What's overrated? Okay, so like...
About this, yeah.
When people treat Asimov like he is the, you know, the bee's knees, the best ever, the, you know, the big deal on the block or whatever. And like, I don't see it yet. I don't see it here.
I have yet to be moved as much as I have been at a science fiction novel as I have when I read The Sparrow. And it's got a lot of this.
With good cause.
And it's got a lot of religion. And it's obviously stands on the shoulders of people that have come before. And that's why you want to give respect to Asimov and others.
I'm not saying disrespect
but
him.
I don't think this book is going to move me like that one.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's a high bar to achieve as far as I'm concerned when it comes to that. But I think it is a good book, and it definitely is. Again, just with how much is going on, you know, consider the time. Yeah, it's a great book. Please, okay. Philip,
what do you think?
Well, overwhelmingly, I agree with Yule. I'm satisfied. I'm entertained. I'm engaged. I'm enthralled, and I want to keep reading it. And I just see these, I guess, tantalizing connections and hints that I find very mentally stimulating. Does that make any sense?
No.
Oh, okay. It doesn't make sense to you because
you're very vague.
Okay.
You're extremely vague in everything you
say. That's fine.
Really?
He was trying to use big words. I find it tantalizing. It's like, what? What do you find tantalizing?
Okay. Well, you know, you asked how I felt about it. That's how I feel about it. That's literally how I feel.
Okay. Well, how about don't take me literally?
Okay.
Every time. Like, everything that Yule talked about is fair game as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
You know, like when he said he liked, you know, the scale and the scope of it, like that's a detail. That's interesting.
Well, then just to elaborate on why I'm so enthralled and about this book and why I find it so stimulating is because he as an Asimov, has come out and said he used like the collapse of the Roman Empire as a template for the story. And just knowing that and then adding on to the fact that I know that Asimov was a devout atheist, and then you really start seeing how this book is written, the way it's written, and why it's written that way. Because to me, I use the example of the Foundation is essentially the papacy, the rise of the Roman Catholic Church, and how it's spread out to everywhere. It influences, you know, kingdoms and countries and everything else, and enormously, unbelievably powerful and influencing, more so back in the day, but certainly still very, very powerful and influential in our world. And so when I see that, and Asimov writes it in a way that kind of seems like the Foundation, aka the Roman Catholic Church, is a little underhanded and devious and not honest. They are rather unswervingly devoted towards accomplishing their objectives.
The ends justifies the means, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, yeah. Don't let your morals get in the way of doing what's right.
Yes. There is a lot at stake, I think, in this story. 30,000 years of chaos and disruption versus 1,000 years of chaos and disruption. Like, that's a...
The other thing about religion is that it also is how easily a religion can come from something, even when it had no desire to be religious and it was steeped in, you know, science, and it still can happen.
It's peddling holy water of a different form. That's kind of how I see it, is the model of religion and the model of the Foundation is the same. Find a way to obtain a devout following and control by any means necessary kingdoms and worlds. You know, it could be Christianity, it could be Coca-Cola, you know, in this case, it's technology and knowledge in general. And if you look at it like this, the Catholic Church they kept knowledge and writing and books alive, and they didn't share that information with people, even with the...
I thought it was the Muslims that did
Well, maybe that's also true, but I'm just...
During the Dark Ages?
Yes, during the Dark Ages. Well, the Muslims kept going in a different way, you know, the Persian Empire, and they kept science and learning, and then they stopped, but I'm...
All the copies of the books, too. Mm-hmm. Like, their libraries mm-hmm. didn't get destroyed or looted or burned for heat.
Well, right. Well, yeah, and, sure. Well, yeah. What I'm getting at is kind of the Catholic Church would preach the Bible, but they wouldn't let anybody read the Bible. They wouldn't teach people how to read the Bible. They controlled the knowledge of the Bible so that they would always be that conduit.
They don't want to teach people how to fish.
Right.
They want to give people fish and loaves so that they can control them forever.
Yeah, if you wanted to go to heaven, you could only do that through a preacher, right?
We'll be having a special section on Martin Luther for next episode.
I don't remember when the Catholic Church was no longer able to charge money for forgiveness, but that was a big part of their business model for a while.
Oh, they still do.
They don't really do it, but like you literally had to pay money at one point in time.
If you want to get your child baptized, that ain't free. If you want to get married in the Catholic Church, that ain't free.
Okay, well, nobody's telling you that you got to be Catholic.
No,
right?
No, I'm just giving an example.
Religion's a tough sell on YouTube, in my opinion.
It is, but you want to know why I was enthralled? It's because I see that the influence of his anti-religious leanings in this book.
Well, and he also doesn't like dum-dums and people that don't like science, and I think that's pretty clear. Do we have any expectations for where this book is going in the next section? Because the next section is the last section, and it's very long.
I assume it's somewhere in the future, and something's going to have happened.
There's another crisis.
And there's going to be some crisis. Smart people outsmarting dumb people.
Possibly Harry Seldon is going to make a return.
Woo!
These are the things I would hope for.
I have that expectation as well. Harry Seldon has not made his final appearance yet.
Yeah, I don't have any real expectation other than just some of the things that we've seen happen. You know, you said, stupid people being outwitted by smart people, probably
what they deserve
from the foundation's angle, and maybe with some sort of religion thrown in.
right. Okay. Well, I hate to be a dud about it. I'm sorry that I don't like it as much as you guys do, but, you know, whatever. You can't win them all.
It's okay to have...
I think it's going to make a great TV show.
It's okay to be contrary.
I think so, too.
Add a little romance, a little kissy-kissy, so the ladies will be happy to watch it with their boys.
Actually, if you just add a lady into the TV series, I think it's...
just one. Please, just
more than
put
somebody
in
on
one.
A video screen, please.
Oh my God, it's hilarious that there are no women in this book. It's absolutely insane. All right, well, I think that does it for this episode. I think we've talked it to death, don't y'all?
For as short as it was, I think we did.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, yeah, we did this for 2 hours. We fucked it.
Well, these people don't know that because some of it's going to be...
a lot of it will get cut out, I'm sure. Well, anyway, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you in the next one. Keep reading, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Do 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 do